You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
It's Monday, so it's time for Shapiro World with David Shapiro from Sasfin Securities in Johannesburg. A nice little bounce back on Friday. Not a little bounce back, a very, very smart bounce back in US markets on Friday, David. And it sort of followed through in the early couple of hours of trading today, Monday. I just wonder if people are saying, well, you know, we had a bit of a shock. We digested the lunacy of the current US administration. And I don't think I'm overstating the case when I say lunacy, because it is. It's madness. But you know what? He can withdraw the tariffs. We don't know what the tariff situation will ultimately reveal about the fragility of the US markets or whatever. So let's just wait and see. I mean, come April the 2nd, when the few more come in, then maybe he's withdrawn them, or maybe they don't have an effect. Maybe people can adapt. So maybe that's the way you're looking at things as well.
I think so. I think nobody expects this to last, simply because the economic consequences will be dire. And somewhere along the line, he'll pull back. Trump and his administration will recognize the mess that they're making and start to kind of roll back on this, because I think the consequences are dire. So the market's corrected for that already. And you know, they thrashed tech shares, and suddenly you start to say, hold on, these companies are still going to do well. They're presenting decent valuations at the moment. So I think there has been that kind of reaction. It's not sustainable at the moment. I wouldn't think we're in line for a massive boom. There's still a lot of worries, and each day with, you know, when Trump addresses his audience and, points his finger at them and so on, I think there will be still bouts of volatility, but what doesn't surprise me, should I say, is that if you go through most of the publications, even the Wall Street Journal, you know, which is a Fox type report, I mean, a Murdoch newspaper, even if you go through newspapers like that or publications, you can see a huge groundswell building against Trump and his administration, particularly Musk. As well, you will see that you haven't heard from us lately. He's just in the background. I think he's been told to go sit in the back office on his chair and do what he's supposed to do. I think there's also the other thing, Lindsay, is a massive groundswell against Tesla. You know, it's becoming a swear name. You don't want to have a Tesla. Don't think I'm, you know, I promise you I'm not exaggerating. You know, it's now become a symbol of, oh, this is Trump administration.
No, I've seen the pictures from the United States. I mean, it happened in France last week, where there was, I think, a Tesla dealership was petrol bombed. And France isn't exactly the most left wing of countries. It's actually quite it's rebellious in its nature. The French always have been, but it's everywhere. And I must say that obviously you mustn't condone this type of unruly behaviour, but on the other hand, there were, I think, 12 dealerships attacked over the weekend in the United States of America, and these weren't radicals with balaclavas on and Molotov cocktails and things. These were normal people that were with placards saying, "Don't buy this stuff because this man is taking away benefits from veterans."
Yeah. From everybody, you know, from without much thought. Yes, he's in a very solid position himself. Personally, he's a very wealthy man, but I don't think he's got any understanding of the unintended consequences of his actions. So I think there is that groundswell. I don't know how it's going to manifest itself, but I don't think they're going to have it as easy as they thought it would be. And nor did they expect the backlash from other countries, from Europe, from Canada, from Mexico. And that's going to be difficult to play, because one thing everybody's telling them, look, this is not – they're going to cost businesses. They're going to increase costs, you know, that rely on imports, and that's going to be higher prices for consumer. There's also retaliatory tariffs that are going to hurt their exports. So there's a lot of skepticism around what the so-called benefits of Trump, or this is what's being questioned. You know, Trump says, yes, we put up tariffs, we're going to get all these masses of money, and with the money we're going to reduce taxes and reduce the deficit and so on. You say, hold on a sec, you know, that's in theory. That's on the back of a matchbox or whatever it is today, on the back of an envelope. We don't use any of those matchboxes or envelopes. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't work that way. So
it doesn't. And you know what? Another thing that really annoys me is I was looking at an interview with the president of Finland, who's on the Russian border, and he was talking in fairly disparaging terms about Putin and the way he approaches the Ukraine situation, and said you've got to be very sceptical. And he was asked about Trump, and he says, don't underestimate the deal-making ability of Trump. Now, I think to myself, well, really? Is he that good a deal maker? He's a failed businessman. He's been he declared himself bankrupt 6 times, and I know that that's to do with tax breaks and intricate legal problems, which I don't really understand. But on the other hand, he's the schoolyard bully that we've spoken about several occasions. Yeah. So you've got little David Shapiro going about his business, playing football in the schoolyard with his mates, and Trump comes up, or rather the schoolyard bully comes up, who's a big beefy fellow with the parents with a flashy car, and says, now listen here, Shapiro, you've got to give me R5,000 a week. In order to, otherwise I'll duff you up. It's the same as Trump. He's not a deal maker. He's just a common bully.
Yeah, that's like calling a mafia boss a deal maker.
Yes.
He is. You know, when he's surrounded by chaps with baseball bats, you're not exactly going to argue. And he's that kind of bully. You know, he's got no diplomacy at all. He's got no finesse to what he does. So, no class. And that's the whole issue. Yes, he's talking with the American economy behind him and plenty of power and the military. But, I think that'll soon pass. And Putin's going to play him.
He's playing him already, of course.
I think a lot of the European, you'll find that the European premiers will also start to play him as well. Yes, he's done some good and he's woken up the UK. He's woken up everybody. And that might be the positive side. But I don't think this is going to last. I don't think he's going to get anywhere close to what he thought he would be. But the other thing is he's erratic. You don't know what's going to come next. He changes all the time. There's no strategic direction. You know, he's got all of this is just make people very uncertain. And you can't make any long-term kind of forecast simply because there's nothing that you don't know what you're going to do. You make a decision today, tomorrow it's different. And then,
people must understand as well is he's not a clever person. He's intellectually and academically rather a dullard, as they say. And he said that they were talking about the EU. He was sitting next to Mark Rutte, the head of NATO, the new head of NATO. And the camera was only focused on Trump. I couldn't see Rutte's reaction when he said the EU was created to destroy the United States of America. I thought, hello, what are you talking about? It was created to destroy the United States of America, he said. And I thought, okay, that's something new. And then he said the EU, he said, is very, very nasty. And again, going back to the schoolyards analogy, it's like someone coming up to you and saying, I'm not going to play with you because you're very, very nasty. It's childish rhetoric, rubbish.
Yeah, I know. Well, he doesn't understand. Europe was made. I mean, there was either neighbors. I mean, they're all, how easy it is for you to get from where you are down to Spain. You know, it's literally get in a train. I don't know how long it's going to take you. You can go to Germany. You can go to any country. It's natural that you should have some kind of economic cooperation, which means you don't have to have border guards. You could just move freely, whatever you want to, the basis of Europe. And also, if you put those economies together, in fact, they were at one point bigger than the United States, credit to the States, that they grew, and Europe had a lot of problems. But they weren't there to design to destroy America. He means they wanted Europe, they wanted another reserve currency, they didn't want to rely on the dollar. It wasn't to destroy it. And I mean, that's really being so hypersensitive.
Hyper stupid.
I don't know. Anyway.
Did you?
Never materialized. Maybe now we'll get some power back into Europe, you know, where they
well, I like the way they're ganging, not ganging up on him, but I mean, Keir Starmer, the UK PM, has sort of put himself forward as the galvanizer of the European nations, although Britain is not in Europe technically, but still sees itself as perhaps getting back in some way. He got 26 people on the telephone over the weekend, and they talked about it, and then there was another meeting as well, everyone coming into number 10 Downing Street. They're sort of saying, okay, we've got to present a united front. And I think that's why European assets, from many asset managers, and I spoke to one this morning, saying, yeah, actually, now's maybe the time to start taking a little bit off the United States table and putting it back into Europe because of valuations, but also because of geopolitics, because they're not going to roll over and play to Trump's tune or dance to Trump's tune.
Well, I you know where it's, there are some really good businesses in Europe. Mm. The only problem is that they've got to get a little bit of Americanism into them. You know, they've got to get that sense of urgency, the sense of on those kind of animal spirits are going right across there. You know, I mean, Greece has managed to pull its way back. Spain is managing to pull its way back.
It's doing very well. Spain is the powerhouse.
If you go through some of the businesses, Lindsay, it's if you look at Europe and you look at some of the businesses there, I mean, there's some really good businesses. If you look at from where can we start? I don't know.
ASML, start there because that's your favorite.
Let's go to these companies. No, let's go to the motor businesses: Rolls Royce, Volkswagen. What else? You've got BMW. You've got some superb BAE Systems, which is a British
aerospace
defense company. Yeah. Mm. You've got Better Beer. Carlsberg makes Budweiser. You know, silly. I mean, Siemens is a pretty good business. So you've got these. When you get to the luxury from, there's no such thing as American luxury items. And I mean, they're awful. You know, so you can't, whether it's LVMH or Hermes, it's a design side of it. You've got Airbus, Novartis, number, you know, plenty. L'Oreal as a beauty company. So there are those businesses. They just need a little bit of, you know, zooming up. I mean, ASML. So it's not that you haven't got these businesses. They are there. They just need the environment in which to improve and do better. Novo Nordisk giving Eli Lilly a run, or it was there before. Mm. So you keep going, you know. There's some pretty decent businesses.
There's some very good businesses. Talking about that, you mentioned luxury goods, America not having any. I noticed a headline that sort of flashed across my screen the other day, and I didn't really pay much attention to it, but I thought of you when I saw it. Someone's buying Prada, and when I see consolidation in an industry, I think, hello, that means that they need to expand somehow, and that means that they're confident about the sector. Who is it that's being put forward as a buyer of Prada? Can you recall?
Prada is a private business. Mm. It's been impossible because I think LVMH, if I'm not mistaken, tried to buy them or might have tried. Everybody's been trying to buy them. That the other one, the other private company is Rolex, but Prada, very difficult. Are you sure they're not buying someone? But that's very interesting if they are trying to sell. You know what I mean?
Well, maybe it's just a hostile takeover or something.
Because they're opening up. I know they're opening up quite a few stores, but that's very interesting that you might say that.
Check
that headline. No, I'm more interested in, you know, I'm not questioning you. I'm just interested who, you know, who would be buying it, because everyone's been after it for a long time. I think they're the Prada sisters, but also quality businesses. And people don't understand what's behind quality? It's craftsmanship.
Mm.
And you can't just create craftsmanship from nothing. So it takes years and years of being passed down of patience. You know, the watchmakers in Switzerland, the people who make the Hermes bags, you know, that's high-level craftsmanship. And this is why people want it, the same as Ferrari. You know, it's not a Mustang. It's a Ferrari.
It's not a Corvette, for goodness sake. Oh, no, here it is, David. I've just Googled it. And, oh, gosh, it wants me to sign up, but I don't want to sign up. Here it goes.
Nice.
Prada closes in on mega $2.5 billion deal to acquire luxury retail rival. So Prada is the predator.
Yes, here. That's what I thought.
Yeah. It's looking to buy Versace from Capri Holdings. There we go. So that's but consolidation is normally quite good, isn't it?
That is. Of course it's good. But I'm surprised. Prada is... You know Versace, all the multicolor. anyway, that's an interesting mix. But I mean, Prada has got a superb name, so I'm sure they put their designers in. Look, a lot of it is the craftsmen that you buy. You know, the designers that you buy with the company. You saw Kering was down. I think they lost a designer, or someone's not happy with who they're buying. I'm not quite sure, because they've been battling on Gucci for a long time. They've been really battling. But that's interesting. Yeah.
Prada's strong financials, including 17% revenue growth to $5.8 billion. Goodness me, make the investment a smart move. And it's reversing the trend of Italian fashion houses going into foreign hands. That's interesting. So they're consolidating within Europe. I quite like that. But do you say Prada's not listed? No.
No. It's one of these desired businesses. I don't think it's listed, no.
You're the luxury boy, so
me and luxury, we go down well. No. I could see you in a Versace shirt,
Well, maybe the last time you saw me, yeah.
Maybe for Purim. You know, Purim's a dress-up. Purim was on Thursday, which is everybody dresses up and has a good time. So, yeah, you'd wear Prada for that,
What did you read over the weekend, David? Let's talk about reading things, because you said off air to me, you've been reading a mass of stuff about Trump and trying to consolidate it into an article for one publication you may be writing for.
You know, it's more to present to clients and to give them some kind of understanding of where we are and what to expect, you know, whether we can get our way out of it. So it's more to explain, you know, why the volatility.
I think David has disappeared because someone's tried to phone him. There we go. Yeah, that's normally what happens. No. But I'll hang on. Oh, there we are. Hello, David.
So I like to, you know, I like the FT. I like The Economist. Certainly the New York Times and Bloomberg's and all of them. And you put together what comments are being made by the writers. You know, there are many cases I wish I could write as articulately as they do. I like The Atlantic very much as well. I love their political articles. So you put it together and you get a picture building up there. There's no support for Trump. I mean, amongst those companies or those editors, publications.
Hmm.
And I rate them very highly. You can see the concerns, and as I say, the concerns about what this means from an economic point of view, you know, is there common sense around this? This is going to drag the economy down. They see they could take growth in the U.S. down from projections of 2.8% all the way down to 2%, which is a lot, you know. Yes. I mean, in terms, it's a big knock. In other words, this is not going to materialize. I think the other one is global uncertainty and political uncertainty in the U.S. And, of course, global concerns as well, you know, because you're building up an anti-American feeling. And also, I think a lot of nations are questioning, is America our ally? You know, for as long as we can remember, we've always not relied on them, but they've always been friends. We just can't trust them anymore. So, and this is going to backlash because, you know, your Yankee go home. Remember Yankee go home? Well, I think you're going to get the same kind of feeling around Europe and other areas as well. Certainly in Canada, Mexico, you don't want to be an American that's going to visit there, because I think there will be some kind of backlash against that. Certainly, maybe not tourists, but from a political point of view. And what you can gather is within the U.S. as well, there's this groundswell against Musk, against Trump, you know, and their policies. I think U.S. aid as well. And you've seen what's happened in South Africa as well, the story now.
With the ambassador, you mean?
I mean, we do the most stupid things, honestly. Really, we need America as well. You know, we certainly do. We need that trading relationship. We just don't need to isolate them. And everything we can do to make the situation worse, we do. You just shake your head and just wonder who's in charge and whether there is anybody with any kind of cop to try and just normalize this relationship. You know, at the moment, they can't even knock the door. They can't even, you know, they can't even get an appointment in America, any of our politicians or, you know, emissaries.
So anyway, what was your conclusion of all those fine publications that you've just mentioned? What they're saying that there's no support for Trump.
No. I think they're portraying or showing a chaotic political and economic landscape under Trump, if you had to put it into one sentence. Yeah. You know, it's chaotic, both politically and economic. And there's no kind of connection between anything he's doing. There's no coherence. And it's very disruptive to the American people and potentially damaging, you know, incredibly damaging both domestically and internationally. And they won't recognize it. They won't just pull back. You know, he believes what he's doing is correct. He's got his clowns around him. I can't explain any. You know, there's nothing more than that. They are clowns.
Well, they're called jesters. You see, they come and present in front of him, and if he finds them funny, using an analogy here, then they say, okay, you can stay. That's what he is. He's the emperor that sits there and says, okay, tell me about it. And as long as they're nice to him, then they keep their job.
Yeah, it's I think it's going to harbor a lot of anti-American feeling wherever you go, and people will by choice. The worst is that you push these nations to, as you say, to join each other and to gang up on America and say, okay, we don't need you. Let's find alternatives. Lindsay, the worst, we know from there's always. You always find a way out. I mean, have a look at Russia. It's still surviving despite sanctions. Iran, yes, it hurts, but they find a way out. And China will find a way around all of this, particularly in tech. And, you know, the chips will eventually find themselves into China. And you can see the development of Chinese tech now. Every day there's a new release of an AI model in China. You know, and America's attempts to starve them of any kind of technology. I understand the reason behind that, but all you do is strengthening your enemies. They will find a way in a world, in a technological world. Someone will come to their assistance, and so I just think his whole diplomacy is this isolationism, American first. Is going to smack him in the face.
Americans are arrogant people. And this that's a gross generalization. I know that. But I remember my mother, my late mother, who was, went through the Blitz in World War II as a young woman. And she, there was a phrase that was coined about American soldiers. And let's make no bones about it. They came in and they helped the war effort enormously. But all the GIs went over to London and to the rest of Europe, etc. And there was a phrase that said, Americans these GIs are overpaid, overdressed, oversexed, and over here. And people didn't like them at all. I don't know. They've just got this sort of brash attitude. But, I mean, good for them if they have that sort of confidence. Anyway, so your clients will be getting your wisdom quite soon, David. And your wisdom is that you just stick with it now because there's fatigue.
There is fatigue. I think valuations are starting to look very attractive. The other point is that even though America slows down, to 2%, it's still double the growth that you're going to see in Europe. Mm. I know the one of the big things that I argue with a lot is that you'll get the argument that Europe is at a 15 to 17 multiple, America's at a 24. That's always going to be – that's like trying to find a discount in Prosus and Naspers. It'll always be there to the underlying Tencent. You know, that's because because Europe is not an aggressive nation. It's not – it hasn't got an equity culture. You know what I mean? So you're not going to find and Americans – sorry, and Americans don't buy European stocks. They don't know Europe. They buy where they're comfortable. So the thing is that Europe, yes, on paper is cheaper, but I don't think that gap will ever close. So I still think that America, if they're good companies, we've always identified these good companies in Europe. We haven't ignored them, but I think they will always trade at probably a discount to America. So the answer is to look for businesses that are not going to be impacted by high tariffs or anything like that. I still think a lot of that lies in the technology sector and those, you know, even some of the pharmaceutical businesses that like the Eli Lilly's and so on. Mm. So, you know, and then the other one is luxury. You know, I still think luxury will beat this off. And so, just stick to the fundamentals. Just stay with – we haven't altered in any way. I haven't altered my portfolios in any way at all.
Good for you. Okay. David, just looking at the JSE today, MTN came out with results. I mean, that's utility now. They're talking about the Naira, and they've managed to absorb the currency volatility of the Nigerian currency. Hulamin coming out as well and getting whacked a bit, but otherwise fairly quiet day. And
not much.
I mean, you obviously have to invest in South Africa for your clients, but
I don't.
Oh, you don't? Okay, no. There we go. Got that one wrong. I thought you had a little portion. No.
Yeah, not at all. Mm. If I do, I buy. There's nothing there in South Africa that. I have very well-run businesses here, but they can't compete on the global stage. And, you know, with the exception of maybe a Richemont, so on, I think there's nothing that can keep up with the kind of growth that we see there. And the other – so, I, you know, from my point of view, that's how I look at businesses. You know, where are they? Can they – you know, can they stand up to some of these big businesses? And the answer is no. And the South African market's getting smaller and smaller and more difficult to play. What you don't realize as well is that we've been kept up by the gold companies, by the Naspers and processes and the good performance of Richemont and so on, some of the miners, which are not related to South Africa at all. But if you look at our market here and, you know, you look at – there's been a big sell-off in retailers, Pepco, Mr. Price, Woolworths, Clicks. All of those are down significantly since the beginning of the ShopRite, even though the index is doing quite well, which is kept up by the big internationals. Down below are a lot of worries about where this economy is going.
Hmm. Okay, David, over the weekend, there were two games that really stood out for me. One was, there he goes again with his phone. Probably call it drive, you see, in Johannesburg, and he hasn't got a signal. But, David, if you can hear me, Newcastle-Liverpool.
Okay.
Did you watch? Oh, good. Newcastle-Liverpool. I was incredibly impressed with Newcastle. They completely dominated Liverpool. Liverpool looked listless. They didn't look interested. I mean, they've got knocked out of the UEFA Champions League by Paris Saint-Germain a few days earlier. Then they get knocked out by Newcastle. And now they've got the league, yeah, sure. But this is supposed to be a season when they got at least three, maybe even four trophies. And they're just getting one now. They look tired and, as I said, disinterested.
You know what I loved about Newcastle, and everybody they played the long ball.
Mm.
They didn't tippy tap, and they just kept that long ball going, pulling back, you know, pushing Liverpool back, making them kind of defend. You know, yes, and then they had to go and try to get their midfield going again. This is Liverpool, and then you had these brutes. What's his name? Bruno Guimarães.
Bruno Guimarães, yeah, Linton, the captain. Yeah.
And Joe, brilliant.
Weren't they good?
play the long ball. Mm. You know, that's what Liverpool. You didn't see Mo Salah. He
didn't
he
touch
didn't
the
appear.
Ball.
Mm. He didn't even sweat. He didn't even have to have a shower.
No.
And I thought they were incredible. You know, and yeah, they nearly blew it, but that always happens.
I'm so pleased for those fans. Yeah. And if you look to the left of your screen, the black and white sea that there was, yeah. And you look to the right, and the Liverpool fans weren't really singing much no. at all. I was so no. pleased. The last trophy they won, domestic trophy, 1955, 70 years ago. I'm sure they're still partying now in Newcastle.
I'm trying to remember as a young kid. Mm. I remember they won the cup in 52 and they won it in 55.
Yes,
they
Jackie
came
Milburn.
To South Africa and there was a game which was 5-3 and I can't get the stats whether South Africa beat them 5-3 or it was 5-3 to Newcastle. There's a lot of conflicting anyway, but I do remember and I couldn't have been more than 4 or 5 or I might have been the older one. I don't know when they came, but definitely saw them. With the FA Cup.
Oh, did you?
Definitely. Yeah.
Oh, did they bring it over? Very good.
They are in a box. Yeah. I remember.
Nice. The other one that caught my eye, I mean, apart from Ipswich confirming that they're going to be relegated, was but you wouldn't have seen it, or maybe you haven't even read about it, was Atletico Madrid, second versus Barcelona.
I didn't watch it.
Okay, 45 minutes, 1-0 to Atletico Madrid, 70 minutes, 2-0 to that team, and then suddenly Barcelona kicked into gear. Lewandowski scored in the 72nd minute, then Naran in the 78th, and then came along the 17-year-old whiz kid, Lamine Yamal, and made it 3-2, and then they made it 4-2. So they got 4 goals in the last...
In 20 minutes.
Yeah, in less actually, yeah, slightly less. it was just amazing. They look as though they're Champions League material. I mean...
Now, Barcelona. Really,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. They have been by far the best team there, yeah.
Mm.
They're on top, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, well, they're playing somebody anyway, but yes... I've got here extracts from the Newcastle Advertiser, 1949 to 1953. Just trying to find this Newcastle visiting South Africa story.
No, they definitely came there at the Rand Stadium.
Okay.
Hmm. I was there, yeah. No,
that's quite a thing.
I can't remember that far back, but we used to go to all the games. My dad. We never missed a game, and in those days, I was one of I was one of 4 brothers. But at that stage, there was not even a baby at that stage. It was just my older brother, myself. My next brother came 52, and then 51. Sorry, 1951, and then 1956. But we used to go to every game, every touring. I saw Bolton, I saw Preston, I saw you name them, Birmingham, everyone. Yeah, Arsenal came out, Spurs came out.
Here we go, Newcastle United, 1952-53 season. During the close season, United undertook an arduous tour of South Africa in which they played 16 matches in 70 days and travelled thousands of miles. There you go. So it was 52-53. and you saw that.
I saw that, yeah.
<It's incredible. laughs>
I remember it. I still remember the South Africa with their green jerseys and certainly Newcastle. Yeah.
Oh,
at the Rand Stadium, no covered stands, nothing at all. Yeah. Hmm. It was winter, it never rained in winter. Dry, grassy patch. Grass, but not watered. No, not green.
Very good. Nice story. Well done. There's lots of pictures. You can look it up. They've updated, obviously. You should look at it. It's called the Internet, David.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going on too much about football. People get so cross with me for doing that. David Shapiro is from Sasson Securities, and that was Shapiro World. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.